You are about to participate in the most ambitious culinary experiment ever imagined.
This competition is going to test everything.
Adapt quickly to anything. I mean anything. The wildest day of your life starts right now.
All new 24 and 24 Last Chef Standing. Sunday night at 8 on Food Network. Stream on Max.
Difficult to keep the line between the past and the present.
Do you believe that someone out of the past can enter and take possession of a living being?
We may be through with the past, but the past is not through with us.
Welcome back to The Next Picture Show, a movie of the week podcast devoted to a classic film and the way it's shaped our thoughts on a current release. I'm Tosh Robinson, here again with
Keith Phipps
and
Scott Tobias.
We've already had a lot to say about John Carpenter's Assault on Precinct 13 and how heavily it was shaped by exploitation cinema and classic westerns from the 50s and 60s, especially a run of films directed by Howard Hawks and starring John Wayne. Given all those influences, it seems fitting that Precinct 13 influenced a new generation of filmmakers in turn, especially Jeremy Saulnier, the writer-director of Murder Party, Blue Ruin, and the new Green Room. Like Precinct 13, Green Room features a group of desperate people cornered by murderers. In this case, the members of a punk band on the road, hiding out in the green room of a seedy backwoods bar, and under siege by a group of white supremacists who want to kill them all to cover up a murder. Anton Yelchin and Aaliyah Shawkat star as two of the band members, who, like the Precinct 13 cops and criminals, are outgunned and relying on wits and desperation. Patrick Stewart plays the bar owner and the organizer of the white supremacists, and he's a pretty terrifying figure. He's also a much more present, personal, and specific threat than the silent hordes in Assault on Precinct 13.
Gentlemen, I hope you appreciate the situation. Things have gone south. No doubt. Now, whatever you saw or did is no longer my concern. But let's be clear. It won't end well.
You're coming.
So, guys, how did you take Green Room? I hear that Scott may still have fingernail marks from Keith.
I'm a jaded moviegoer, and it takes a lot to get me to jump or really go ugh in disgust. And I was doing that several times in this film. It's a rough ride. I love the movie, but it is not for the faint of heart. Which is part of why Genevieve is not talking in this episode as one of the faint of heart. But
a self-proclaimed faint of heart person. I think that she probably could have stomached it. There really are, we're going to talk about violence very shortly and probably in some detail. Mm-hmm. I believe Scott's usual words are my beloved violence. Mm-hmm. But there are only a few shots in this film that are really graphic. Mostly it's just the tension.
Yeah, that's the thing. I think there that it gives you the, and this is great filmmaking, it gives you the impression of it being much more unpalatable and gross than it is.
It's got its moments, though.
It does have its moments. In the moments, you know, he makes them count.
That's a Carpenter touch, too.
That's for like, sure.
You know, when you do see the violence, it has great impact. But you know, it's Halloween is a movie that you can see and feel like you've seen a lot more explicit violence than you actually have. You can probably, the actual moments of explicit violence in this are, you can count on one hand what they are. They don't necessarily even last that long. But boy, do you feel them.
Yeah.
And in part, you feel them more because they're so brief. I mean, there's a character who takes some damage and you literally see it for maybe 2 seconds. And because he doesn't linger on it, it lingers in your imagination. You know, the fact that the wounds are so quickly covered up means you're thinking about them for most of the rest of the film.
The arm?
Yes.
Yeah. It's like, yeah, just don't put your arm outside a door where people have machetes. That's a good rule of thumb. But there, it should also be said that some of the deaths and violence in the film are super explicit, like just, you know, and also, you know, and fast. Well, you know, the film starts, and I think the film could be quite fascinating just as a road movie about a touring punk band, because the Ain't Rights, this band from punk band from Virginia, finds himself in the Pacific Northwest, and it's been a long and terrible tour. And the film begins with them out of their van, out of gas, in the middle of a cornfield, and you know, in the first of many times when the film defies expectations, they go to siphon gas from another car, which they've been doing the entire ride, and you think they're going to get nabbed, something's going to happen, but now they just fuel up the car and go, and that's the way this band, you know, that's making barely $10 a piece on door charges is getting around. You know, they're just barely scraping by. But there's I think a telling moment thematically early on where they're being interviewed by this, you know, punk kid who's a journalist, but he also kind of helped, you know, set up this gig for them. And he's asking Anton Yelchin about why the band doesn't have any social media presence. And I think that it, his answer and you know, and really just the film itself is about kind of going back to that feeling of being there, of immediacy, of being in the moment, you know. And you know, another sort of running gag in the film has to do with, you know, Desert Island albums. You know, you got this group of punks, but their Desert Island albums, when it comes down to it, are these pretty chart-topping pop favorites. There are people like Madonna and
Simon and Garfunkel. One of them sticks with the Misfits. So
one of them sticks with the Misfits, but punk is not something that is really well bottled on an album that you would want to listen to over and over again. It is something that you go to, and it is an event that you go to and you feel.
I think it's neat too that one of the few sort of stylistic flourish is that they do that slow motion shot of the crowd, the band playing in the crowd enjoying it, and where the soundtrack kind of drops out and becomes sort of, you know, soundtrack music and not the actual song they're playing, and it kind of captures this moment of bonding between the band and the crowd, even though, as we'll soon find out, if we don't know already, the band and the crowd don't have that much in common.
Well, I mean, and they start by deliberately antagonizing them, mm-hmm. and which is a very punk thing to do. There's that moment where Yelchin's character decides, you know, we're going to go on, and the first thing we're going to do is just completely tick these people off. Like, that's a very bold move, and it's a very interesting character move because he's doing it so deliberately. It's not a careless thing. He is not unaware of the situation, but he is making a conscious decision to kind of put them all in danger just to stick by his ideals.
Like, to specify that at this point, realizing they're playing for white supremacists, they decide to play the Dead Kennedy song Nazi Punks F word off.
Which you can barely understand the lyrics, but you can feel the anger in the room like instantaneously.
Well, I think the crowd would know the song too.
Oh, yeah. Sure. Yeah. Sure. I mean, there's that the response is so instantaneous. Like I mean, it's almost like they're shaking hands. Hello. Like, we know what we're doing. You know what we're doing. We're all very angry here. And it feels like a miracle when we like one song later, everybody seems to be on the same page again. But one of the things about that kind of that introductory sequence mm-hmm. that you're talking about, it made me really dislike these characters. Why? Because they're because of their attitude, because they're thieves, because they live by thievery, because they've got such attitudes towards each other. And for me,
you try living in a van.
I think it's a beautiful thing, because I think one of the things that the film did for me was bring me around so quickly on like desperately liking these people and wanting them to survive. That opening made me feel like this was kind of a conventional slasher where you're going to see these, you know, annoying kids picked off one by one. It just seems to me that it happens so quickly that Jeremy Saulnier like flips that script and puts you in these people's shoes and makes them seem like a unit. It takes one act of horrific violence to suddenly make them a unit that cares about each other.
Well, it's also made a little bit easier by the fact that they're playing for a bunch of white supremacists. I think then you can identify with them far more than the crowd they're playing with. But I guess we're gonna have to agree to disagree about how it feel about the characters as the film opens. I was immediately taken with them and wanted their success and respected, you know, what they were trying to do, which is so much against the grain, the shunning of commercial, of any kind of commercial success, or even enough success to earn them, you know, the money to get home. I mean, that's why they take this gig. This gig is available for them, you know, is given to them out of pity, really, and they can make a quick $350 and maybe get a third of the way through the country before having to siphon more gas again. But I appreciated their kind of old school punk values, and I think that is such an animating factor of this film, not just those characters, but just the aesthetic of the film. It is very much a punk film in spirit. I think you see it in the way the film is cut too. There's always, you know, it feels like there's so many moments in the film where an edit happens a couple of beats before you expect it to. It's so tight and yet also kind of jagged and you know, purposefully rough. It's impressive.
And I mean, Sonya has been very specific about the fact that, like, he was a young punk, mm-hmm. that this is like going back to not just the music of his youth, like the music that he loved as like an angry 19-year-old, but a scene that he was part of and a scene that he saw being taken over by skinheads and being taken over by violence. He was part of the DC punk scene, and there was a real skinhead problem. And there was, he, as he puts it, you know, there was nightly violence between people who considered themselves straight edge and people who considered themselves skinheads, who all were interested in the same music and the same scene, but disagreed very fervently about the direction that scene should go. And you can feel that as like part of the not deeply explained but very present dynamic here, like from the moment that the Ain't Rights take the stage.
Yeah, it's a familiar bad chemistry because there is this weird crossover between people from distant parts of the ideological spectrum sharing space together.
It's sort of interesting too that he puts the two elements that are not posers in any way. Imagine that in the scene he's talking about, there is enough gray area. There's people that are just kind of playing the part of a left wing punk or playing the part of a skinhead. But these are actual white supremacists, and these is a punk band that doesn't even have a social media presence in 2015. You know, these are the hardcore of both ends of the spectrum here.
Well, with the white supremacists in specific, there's kind of the scenesters, and then there are the red shoelace people,
right?
And as the film progresses, you get the sense that somebody actually says at one point, you know, this is true believers. We've got true believers, sure, here. And as the film progresses, you see more and more of these people who are deeply in the scene, of course, led by Patrick Stewart's character, Darcy, who I remember 2 years ago when the news hit that Patrick Stewart was playing a white supremacist in a horror film. And the adulation, like the excitement of that concept, it was really fun to watch. Like, people were really receptive to and excited by the idea.
He doesn't overplay it. It's not an arch performance. Mm-mm. If anything, it's kind of an understated performance, and I think it's really effective that way too. But you know, it's not just Jean-Luc Picard barking, you know, Nazi sentiments or whatever.
But it's not either. I mean, he's both cast way against type and to type, because he is a, you know, a quiet, controlled leader in
authority
a lot of
figure.
Way. He's an authority figure. He has cause for frustration and anger, I suppose, as the film goes on. But his decision-making throughout is pretty clear, and his leadership is pretty clear. Though, you know, the one thing that I'm curious about, too, I mean, if we're talking about white supremacy, is just how much that is window dressing, really, in the film. I mean, the symbols are everywhere, the ideology is kind of absent.
I think these are interesting films to look at together because of the politics of them, which are a little muted, but you can't really ignore them either. To start with Assault on Precinct 13, I mean, you have to, in some ways, what's going on in that film may look a little more far-fetched now than it did in the 1970s when, you know, came out in 76. This is 2 years after the Patty Hearst kidnapping. You know, the SLA, the group that kidnapped her, would have been in the news anyway, which is sort of this band of urban terrorists with a vague but insistent left-wing agenda that was not afraid to commit violent acts to do it. And, like, you know, when they essentially part of the condition of holding her hostage was trying to get the wealth redistribution programs in place, some of which they were actually effective in doing. I mean, there was this real sense that, especially coming out of the late 60s, everything from the Black Panthers to the Weather Underground, the sense that armed bands of political extremists could, if not affect lasting change in the American culture, at least destabilize it. And we don't know what the gang members in this film want, but I think they very much read as urban revolutionaries. And I think, it's almost cartoonish that we talked about the Rainbow Coalition of gangs in this, where you have characters known only as the White Warlord, the Black Warlord. I think it's
Oriental
Warlord and the Hispanic, I believe it's Hispanic Warlord, but it's like, we're not going to leave anyone out. But that being said, there would have been representative groups for most of those people, in the sort of the culture of urban terrorism that was going on at the time. In some ways, I think Carpenter is not even entirely unsympathetic to that point of view, because the film does open with that horrific scene of faceless policemen gunning down gang associates unnecessarily. I mean, it is. Police violence, police brutality, clearly.
Those people are armed. Like, you really don't have a sense for what's going on.
True, but I think it is sort of a shoot first, ask questions later scenario as well on the behalf of the...
It feels like an execution.
Yeah, exactly. So, there is sort of a cycle of violence playing out between the sort of, extreme law and order enforcement and the gangs in the street. And I think it's not exactly window dressing, but you can't really ignore it. To use Scott's word, window dressing. I think there's a little bit of that in Green Room as well, because there's some interesting parallels, as I kind of suggested before, between the punks and the white supremacists. They are, when they go to the apartment of the student journalist that's interviewing them and promoting their gig, which is not necessarily the best use of journalistic ethics there. There's copious postering and stickering, and when you go to the club, they end up in the white supremacist club. It's almost like a parallel universe where there's a lot of posters and stickers too. They just happen to have like awful white supremacist messages on them, but there is this is an American History X. I don't know if it's necessarily interested in plunging into how people become white supremacists. But, I think it's not an accident that they're white supremacists. I think it's what you do see of that culture is interesting. And I think the clash of philosophies is very much in play there, too. There's also the Assault on Precinct 13 dynamic playing out, where they have to bond with the white supremacist fan played by Imogene Poots, or I think she's somewhat reluctantly along for the ride with the white supremacist thing, but she did enter into it voluntarily. They had to bond with her to defeat a common enemy, I think the politics in here are muted, but they're not. You shouldn't ignore them either.
No, I think that, Jeremy Saulnier and Macon Blair, who starred in Blue Ruin and...
Who's very good here, too.
Yeah, he's got a relatively small role, but it's very different from his Blue Ruin role, and he's really, really good. He co-produced again, and he co-stars again, and he does a lot of consulting with Saulnier, so you can consider his voice as part of this. They've talked about how the two of them, when Patrick Stewart came on board, he said, I want a backstory for my character. I don't want it in the film. I don't want to make any like speeches about what I believe or like why I believe it, but I want to know where that character's coming from. And they'd actually done a ton of research into the white supremacy movement in the United States. And they basically put together a backstory for him just for his perusal, just for him to understand the character, based on a bunch of specific white supremacist leaders. And that's where they're kind of coming from, is like from an informed place about the politics that leaves all of the politics off screen. Mm. And I think that's a really smart decision, because by not putting out the can't out there, by not having anybody like giving big moral speeches about what they believe or why, it kind of takes away the audience thinking about any of those arguments and trying to analyze them or trying to decide where they stand on them. in the end, what you have is a bunch of murderers trying to murder a bunch of people who don't want to be murdered. Mm-hmm. And that's a lot more relatable than if you became too detailed about the politics. And you see that in Assault on Precinct 13. Like, regardless of where you stand on the rise of gangs or white flight or like the progressive abandonment of areas of the city, you sympathize with people who don't want to be murdered. And if you lay out too much of the politics, suddenly you get into a Death Wish 3 kind of situation where it can seem really cartoony,
right,
to use these elements to background such a like an exploitation film model. But I find it really interesting that Green Room in particular just kind of seems to use that all as a backdrop for letting you understand that these people are a certain kind of ruthless, and that Darcy in particular is somebody who's come from a place where he expects to use violence as part of his politics. He expects to have people around him who do not flinch at violence as part of their politics. And that puts him in a situation where he can bring violence to bear when he has a situation that he thinks needs violence.
I really don't see the politics, I guess, of Green Room quite as strongly as I do Assault on Precinct 13. What I think is conceptually interesting about Green Room is that these two camps do, they're both, you know, they're outsiders, and they both do mingle in the same scene. Not just this specific situation where this is skinhead territory that the punks are sort of invading in a way, or being brought into the two, but you know, the scene that Saunier remembers from DC, there were occasional skinhead elements, and there was bits of violence. You know, he I interviewed him, and he was talking about it, a situation where a club was shut down, and he had exited the club by walking through spatters of blood. And this is kind of a blown up graphic novel-ish version of that, but it is fascinating to me that people do find some kind of a weird common ground, I guess, in aggression, even though they come to it from completely different areas ideologically. I mean, that's kind of an interesting conflict to me. It's just sort of writ large in this film that these groups that come together under kind of normal circumstances and come together poorly under normal circumstances, now they're in the situation where all of that conflict and intermingling and bad chemistry is just blows up.
Yeah, it seems like in Green Room, both the punk group and the skinhead group are in the same kind of place of being young and frustrated and needing some way to work off that energy. And what one of the things that makes Patrick Stewart's character so interesting, and Macon Blair's for that matter, is that they come into it as adults. And with Darcy, there's a feeling that like he's not at the bar until he's called in because there's an incident. You know, he may have passed out of the place where he needs this kind of energy in his life on a daily basis, and now he's just profiting off of it. You know, it's a business for him. He still retains that potential for violence, that ability to violence, but he banks it until he needs it because he doesn't need to express it by moshing. He doesn't need to express it by playing punk music. He's like, he's an old punk. He's kind of retreated into his shell. And I feel like Assault on Precinct 13 comes from a very different dynamic as far as that's concerned, because none of the people in the police station feel like they're particularly predisposed towards violence. They have to find the violence within them in order to survive, but they're fending off people who live in a culture of violence and who have, it seems, been placed into that culture of violence by the cycle of violence. I'm saying the word violence a lot. Keith, do you have any final thoughts on your topic before we throw to Scott and violence?
I think final thought is one that just occurred to me, is that one thing that both sides have in common is they are enthralled to and idealizing a scene that predates their birth by a couple of decades, really. Mm-hmm. I mean, the punks hold up this sort of early 80s Washington, D.C. punk scene as this ideal. And it's not that different in terms of looking to the past for guidance as the neo-Nazis and the white supremacist group in some ways. And obviously, one is a much more, I think, humane philosophy than the other, but that is, they are both sort of worshipful of the past and in some of the same ways.
Well, that's really interesting. You know what else they worship? Violence. Scott?
Okay. Well, you know, my topic is violence. You know, we talked in the first segment about the shooting of the little girl in Assault on Precinct 13 being, you know, a signal that nothing was off the table. You know, and Green Room does not have a single incident that's quite as shocking, but I think it's critical to the film's punk spirit that the violence be explicit and visceral. And that brings it in line with Saulnier's last film, Blue Ruin, which is a revenge film about an ordinary man trying to commit violence and the gruesome consequences of being an amateur at doing so. You know, Green Room, like Assault on Precinct 13 or Straw Dogs, which is another massive influence, emphasizes the physical struggle of trying to get out of a seemingly impossible situation. You know, the Ain't Rights take heavy casualties going up against a much larger and better armed force, and the violence underlines just what a difficult undertaking this is. You know, those machetes that are prominent in the film, it feels almost kind of like chopping through forest brush in A Gear of the Wrath of God. You know, I mean, we have to feel it. And thematically too, it fits into this movie that's just about the experiential nature of punk. And I think that just any movie with a mosh pit should not be shy about getting a little physical. So yeah, it just feels like form and content really come together quite beautifully with Green Room. I think you I feel like this is a theatrical experience. You know, we were joking earlier about how well Genevieve might handle a film such as this, but you know, the crowd that we saw it with was very excited and engaged and enthusiastic, and there was some clapping. And I think on a fundamental level, it has some shocking moments of violence. Keith was a little shaken by it, but it's mostly just tense. And
I think the sound was ugh.
It was tense. It's just a very well executed thriller. Just it's a great piece of craftsmanship. Not just gore and guts. It's got a lot of style, and he's a really talented filmmaker.
You were saying in the previous episodes of the show, like your next picture show recommendation was for a return to to graphic violence,
on screen violence. Yes,
graphic on screen violence as an artistic statement, as opposed to withholding violence in order to be thought of as arty. This film is very minimal with the on-screen violence. It's just very graphic on-screen violence when it's there. Did this fit your bill?
It did. It did. I mean, the film I was talking about the previous show was Eastern Promises, the David Cronenberg film, and just David Cronenberg films in general are going to show you a lot of violence rather than do a lot of things off screen. And it is important in that film. There's no guns at all in that movie. That is all knives and fists. And it, you know, emphasize, and The Revenant was that way too. If you want to go back even further, you know, these movies really do try to communicate that physical struggle. And that's part of where they draw attention. And that is what you have to go through in order to get to the other side. I mean, Straw Dogs is all about, you know, Dustin Hoffman becoming a man, basically.
Mm-hmm. By defending his turf
and doing it through, you know, extraordinary, you know, gut-wrenching violence. And so Green Room, I think, follows in that tradition.
You know, you talk about the violence in Assault on Precinct 13 being more shocking to you. The gunning down of the little girl to me is not as visceral. Maybe it's because I'm the only one, like, currently talking on this podcast that does not have a daughter.
Well, it's something you don't see very often, I don't think. Just see you know, a perfectly innocent child getting gunned down in cold blood is even for a genre film like Assault on Precinct 13, that's pretty rare.
Oh, it's very rare, and it's certainly surprising and horrifying. But it didn't hit me in the visceral place that Green Room did. And part of that, I think, is because, because of the effects. You know, there's something about that 70s blood effect that looks exactly like house paint. You know, the weird, slick, shiny, super bright red.
Sure.
As much as Assault on Precinct 13 is built around these, like, sudden acts of shocking violence, there's also just something a little of its era, like a little cartoony to me. Whereas Green Room and Blue Ruin before it just feel very real to me. I think one of Saulnier's, like, real skills is making these people feel real, mm-hmm. and making the violence feel real. He shoots violence in a way that feels like violence in real life does. If you've ever been around, you know, something horrifically violent happening, there is a bluntness and suddenness to it. And he's shooting things that could be interpreted as slasher movies if they played very differently, if they were written and scripted and shot differently. You have just this series of people being mown down one by one, but he doesn't linger on the kill shots, and he doesn't give you a sense that you should be going, "Woohoo, that was an amazing murder." Like, he makes these people so real, and he makes the violence feel so visceral. It's hard to know how to react except with that kind of reaction.
Yeah, Sony is really good at that. I mean, in Blue Rune as well, there's sort of the sense of how hard it is to kill somebody or knock somebody out, or how it's never clean, or, you know, it's so rarely clean or quick. I mean, in Green Room, there's all the scenes with the big, tough bodyguard-looking, wrestler-looking guy and, you know, subduing him and trying to, you know, keep him from doing anything. And it's hard. It's hard to take another person down. You don't often see that in films. And I think in this, it plays out in a way that's, as you said, really uncomfortably close to what real life violence is like.
Blue Ruin owed quite a bit. Well, I think both films really owe quite a bit to the Coen brothers. Blue Ruin especially owes a lot to Blood Simple. And the Coens love that. That's something they return to constantly, is our people involved in crimes who are not used to committing them or being involved in violence, who do not commit violence. And so it does have that messiness. It also has a comic value too. I mean, Blue Ruin is as much a comedy as it is a thriller. And I think there's certainly some comic relief to Green Room as well, but, you know, I think it's part of the tension of the film is to understand that and identify with these people in all of their vulnerability and in humanity. They're not the situation does not turn them into superhumans. I mean, and I guess maybe you could cite Die Hard as a similar type of situation. You know, the first Die Hard, what made it so much better than the sequels is that we sensed that Bruce Willis's character was, you know, human and bled, and, you know, he had cuts on his feet, and, you know, and you got a sense of his physical struggle. I think it's really important to the tension of the film that they be that relatable.
One of the things that all these films have in common, Blue Ruin, Green Room, Assault on Precinct 13, and Die Hard, is the rarity of weapons, the scramble to get your hands on a weapon, and what a difference that makes having a gun and ammo in hand. You know, by the end of Precinct 13, they're down to three bullets, and they've got to make one of those bullets count, and they're relying on jury-rigged weapons to take out their enemies. Blue Ruin, Macon Blair, one of the more comic sequences is him struggling to get his hands on a gun and to make that gun usable. And in Green Room, some horrible things happen around trying to get their hands on guns.
Yeah. Well, I mean, that's the first negotiation is the punks have a gun, and they're not going to go any further in this negotiation until the Patrick Stewart, Darcy gets that gun from them. But
it makes violence so much harder and so much more visceral if the people don't have guns. And one of the, I mean, I could go on all night about the reasons that the Assault on Precinct 13 remake doesn't work. But one of the big ones is really early on, they let the criminals out and they say, here is our giant cache of weapons. And people start spraying automatic fire around, like, for fun, basically. I mean, they end up with gigantic stashes of weapons and ammo, and it turns into a big happy gun party, and it makes it all very unreal.
It's terrible. I'm glad I didn't see this thing. That's a horrible, horrible twist on the original, which is about making the most of what little you have. But, you know, one thing I really like about this film, and again, it speaks to the desperation of it, is that you know, they're in this room and they have to get out of the club. That is the basic situation. They're stuck in this room and they're way outnumbered outside and they have to get out. That's the conflict. And what I like about it is that they try a couple of different times and fail to leave and have to retreat, and they retreat with fewer than they came out with. I like that, of just being able to of making an effort, of being courageous, of being as industrious as they possibly can, and failing.
I mean, a part of that, I kept thinking of Panic Room at various points during the film because of that same dynamic of we can leave, but if we stay out of the room too long, we're all going to die. So it just becomes about, like, what can we gain while we're out? Mm-hmm. But one of the things that I connected to most in Green Room and found most fascinating about it was Mark Webber's character. He's playing one of the punks, and he's the only one of them that seems to actually understand violence. Mm-hmm. He's not a hugely violent man, but he knows how to take control of somebody who's bigger than him and shut him down. He knows how to handle himself. He knows how to handle a gun. And he changes the dynamic so thoroughly just by being almost as comfortable with violence as the people that are coming at them. He becomes almost more of a resource than the gun just because he knows how to actually fight back. And I found his character fascinating.
Yeah, for sure. It's again, almost John Carpenter or Hawksian, like how little is spelled out of these characters, but how much we get to know them just through what they do. And, like, you know, it's not like there's this awkward setup. It's like, you used to wrestle in high school, didn't you? Like, in the early scene, but you see him, you know, handling things in a way that someone who clearly knows what he's doing would, that you know, you get to know that. It's nicely done. I really got a sense of who all these people were.
Yeah, and who the dogs were too.
I was gonna say
it's a pretty nuanced portrait of dogs.
Yeah, we really couldn't leave violence without seeing how the dog violence sat with Keith, who was our resident deep-seated dog lover.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think take nothing away from Scott or Genevieve, who are also fond of dogs. But I'm sort of on record as not doing well with dog violence. But there's sort of this snarling, you know, dog that's going to kill you thing, the element that kind of shuts off that part of my brain. You know, I don't want to see the dogs hurt, but the dogs in this are such a threat that my recoiling at violence toward dogs kind of is off the table with this one.
But then
I know
you get a little dog redemption.
You get a little dog redemption.
It's so,
yeah.
It's so sweet. It is. You're like, oh, this is just a dog.
Yeah, it's nicely. No, it's nicely done.
Very nice.
And it's part of what Saunier seems to be saying about the cycle of violence and how violence begets violence. And if you can, like, let go of it just briefly, mm-hmm. I mean, there's that sense that these dogs are being forced towards. They've been trained towards violence. They've been forced towards violence. Once the person who's, like, exacerbating the situation is gone, suddenly it's just a dog.
Yeah, that's nicely set up in this film, and the parallel between the dogs and the people under the thrall of Darcy and others is not, they don't put too fine a point on it, but it's not hard to see.
Well, one of the things I appreciated about the film, and I think this maybe speaks to your topic, Tasha, is how well it's structured and how it sets certain things up and calls back to things that it did before. I think you expect certain things to happen and they don't. I mean, it's a sophisticated piece of writing.
Oh yeah, and I mean, one of the things that struck me most about it, I just kind of wanted to talk about the callbacks in both films, because both films kind of operate on this cycle of repeated references. In Assault on Precinct 13, it's Napoleon constantly asking, gotta smoke, gotta smoke, gotta mm-hmm. smoke, and then once he gets a smoke, you're kind of like, ah, we can be done with that. Like, that's fine. And then, like, 5 minutes later, he's like, gotta smoke. And it becomes this running punchline. But so does people asking him about his name and his refusal to discuss it. There's just this kind of sense of buildup and payoff that goes throughout. And that by the end has become this comfortable in-joke that binds the characters together. Mm-hmm. In Green Room, it's the same thing. Like, in a dark way, there's sort of the constant threat of the dogs and how that ends up being paid off at the end. But in a lighter way, there's the whole business with the Desert Island yes. bands, which at the end of the movie becomes God. A punchline.
The best possible. I think I cannot. That is like Casablanca-level great last lines for me. That I love the way that is paid off.
And it's just, it's a really realistic acknowledgement of, like, what they've been through and what all of this means at this point. So I don't have a huge point to make. I just think it's interesting how both movies kind of insert the running gag, even in moments of tension, in order to pay it off at the end and release that tension. You know, it's kind of a beginning to end. Both of them have these in-jokes that start before the violence and the tension start. are referenced during the height of the tension and then come back at the end as kind of a, hey, remember who we all were like an hour and a half ago before things were terrible. Mm-hmm. And both of them just end up being both a reminder of those earlier times and then just kind of a release in a way that I found really interesting.
Another thing I think that I liked about the film too is that it really plays with what you're trained to think is going to happen. A couple of examples. One is that they do find a secret room under the green room, right? I mean, there is an escape hatch, but the hatch is locked, so they're screwed. So that happens. And then there's another moment where, you know, one of the punks is very hurt, but not dead. Is bleeding out. And the order is not to kill this person, but to just let them bleed out. And so as an audience member, you're thinking, aha, this character is going to come back later, and it doesn't happen. The character has presumably passed away. So, you know, it's these are small touches, but I do like that the film, you know, is conscious of what someone in the audience is going to expect and then just subverts those expectations in really small but effective ways.
And it doesn't comment on the fact that it subverted them. Especially with the wounded punk who doesn't come back.
Yeah.
Like, that was a huge shock for me that didn't happen. But nothing is said about it because nobody's really aware of it. And that in and of itself makes his death more tragic. I mean, it's almost like Sonia subverting the whole idea of, you know, the kill shot, the death scene, the big moment. He dies somewhere quietly off screen and nobody knows exactly when or exactly how it happened. And to me, that makes it even more of a tragedy.
He doesn't come back, you know, coughing up blood and going, yeah, F Hitler, bang, bang. You know, no.
That's what that movie needed at the end instead of the punchline that we get.
To see this movie is to see what other movies do wrong. You know, it's a nice example of let's shave off every possible cliche we have and let's see what's left. And it's quite striking, this film.
I don't think there's anything more to be said about that then. Assault on Precinct 13 is available on DVD, Blu-ray, and on streaming services. Green Room is currently in theaters, and we hope that you will see it there because it really packs a punch in a dark theater. And we'll be right back with our usual recommendation segment, Your Next Picture Show. Finally, it's time to catch each other up on films or film-related items we've seen in the interim since our last podcast. We call it Your Next Picture Show in the hopes that it'll put some interesting choices on your radar. Keith, you want to kick us off?
Yeah, sure, absolutely. This one kind of spins directly out of what we were talking about, and I referenced it earlier, which is Only Angels Have Wings, a Howard Hawks film from 1939. It just came out on Criterion in a new Blu-ray edition, and what's interesting about this film is I don't know that it's necessarily like the first or even the fifth film that comes to mind when people think of Howard Hawks, but is the most Howard Hawks films there is. I mean, it is such a, you know, characters hanging out together, you know, makeshift family forming around a common goal. And in this case, it's delivering the mail in South America under very dangerous conditions. You know, and wonderfully drawn characters, you know, played by lead is Cary Grant, as the pilot and head of the other pilots, and Jean Arthur as a chorus girl that kind of steps off in his the fictional South American port city where his operation is based, and decides to stick around because she's kind of she falls for him and also kind of falls for the whole situation. You know, it's funny and it's tense and it's filled with these characters who have kind of developed an attitude toward life that doesn't so much scoff at death, but kind of learns to live with it. And it is from top to bottom, just wonderfully cast. I mean, it's Cary Grant, it's Jean Arthur. You don't get much better than that. It's one of the breakthrough films for Rita Hayworth. It's got Thomas Mitchell, who you'll know from It's a Wonderful Life and many other movies, you know, on down to like Noah Beery Jr. deep in the credits. It is a delight. And it is, while it's not the most direct influence on Assault in Precinct 13 and Green Room, it is the DNA for especially, you know, Assault. It can be traced back to this film and Howard Hawks in general. And if you've only seen the best known Howard Hawks films, go a little deeper. This is one of the best, if not the best known.
I remember it as just really feeling innovative in terms of character and relationships. It's pre-code, isn't it?
No, it's not pre-code, but it's certainly it is clear That Cary Grant is someone who's kind of slept his way through Central America and the Caribbean, and that Jean Arthur has been around as well, and it skirts the code very in some very interesting ways.
Yeah, mostly I just one of the things that hit home for me most about that film was a sense of a very particular scene that mm-hmm. we don't see much of in cinema, and a sense of very particular relationships that feel very true to life and not very true to cinematic romance and kind of the cliches of that. I remember it as feeling really unusual and distinctive in a really pleasing way.
In some ways, it has some parallels to Casablanca too, where it's there's this far-flung location and people from different parts of the world thrown together who wouldn't normally necessarily be rubbing shoulders, and how they interact with each other. And it's also, it's filled with colorful characters. It's a good one. Touch, what about you? What do you have to recommend for us?
You know, I also kind of went with the inspired by this particular conversation recommendation. Back when we were at the Dissolve, a little film called The Guest came out. And the little happy noises coming off Genevieve make me happy. Directed by Adam Wingard, written by Simon Barrett, starring Dan Stevens from Downton Abbey. We all really liked this film, and it was kind of the last film that I think I felt about exactly the way I feel about Green Room, as it just being like full of surprises and full of innovations, but also very consciously an 80s throwback, like referencing these old films, referencing films in a Carpenterian kind of way. And yet it, like, where I think Green Room is going to do at least reasonably well because word of mouth on it is so strong, The Guest kind of sunk a little, and it was really saddening because it's such a small movie in some ways, but it's centered on such a memorable and distinctive performance. And it's full of surprises. It's full of memorable and distinctive surprises. It's also a film very much made for cinephiles and very much made for people who are familiar with, you know, Carpenter's oeuvre and kind of the exploitation / fun violence films of the late 70s and early 80s. It's streaming on Netflix now, so it's really, really easy to access. And I have to throw in that I did an interview with Wingard Barrett and Stevens back in the day at the Dissolve, and it was one of my favorite things that I ever did for the site. I really enjoyed talking to those guys. They were really smart about what they were trying to do in terms of balancing tone and content and referencing all of these classics of 80s cinema in a really fun way. So I hope that now that it's on Netflix, people who didn't find it in the day will go back and find it.
Yeah, it's so good. We saw it together, Tasha. And I remember leaving the theater and thinking, I love this movie. I'm so worried I'm going to get into a row with Tasha over it. And I was very relieved and happy that that we were kind of on the same page as thinking that it was terrific fun. Yeah, another wonderful homage to Carpenter. I mean, everyone owes something to Carpenter. I just wish one of those retro Carpenter films would take off. It really hasn't happened yet.
Yeah, I know. Well, when I was reading that the Entertainment Weekly piece listing off all of
the Purge was okay, but I mean, come on.
Yeah, I mean, The Purge is kind of the cheap one. But all of those films that article referenced, it was The Purge, The Guest, and like four films I've
never
even heard of.
Cold in July, Stage Fright, Almost Human.
And apart from The Guest and The Purge, I haven't seen any of those movies. I'd barely heard of any of them. So I don't know. Am I missing some gems in there?
I think you're missing Cold in July. I didn't think much of Stage Fright or Almost Human, but...
So you're right, Scott. It is fairly unusual for the two of us to be so thoroughly on the same page, particularly about an exploitation-tinged movie with a lot of violence. Mm-hmm. We tend to come to those from very different angles.
And Green Room is the same
exactly.
way.
Exactly.
So when when we are together on these things, that this is... powerful stuff.
Speaking of things we could be together on, what do you have for us?
I have a movie that you can't see right now, but I wanted to bring it up anyway. It's called Starless Dreams. It was my favorite movie out of the True False Film Festival. It's the best film I've ever reviewed for Variety. And this week, it both won the Full Frame Documentary Festival, which is a pretty big deal, and it picked up a distributor. in the U.S. In Cinema Guild, which should be releasing it later this year. And it's an Iranian documentary by a director named Mehrdad Oskway, who's now made three films about kids in juvenile detention facilities. His previous two films were about boys. Starless Dreams is about girls. And what's remarkable about this film, and I think this is true of Iranian cinema in general, is its simplicity. Oskway turns his camera on girls who have known nothing but poverty, abuse, and oppression their whole lives, and you get the sense that they're just being listened to for the first time, and it's such a direct and extraordinarily powerful experience on its own just to hear those stories. But then on top of that, he gives you a sense of this detention facility as a place where these girls can be kids and can bond and have friendships and play and have some innocence restored. The film almost turns really on this irony that they become so close that they don't want to leave. They don't want to leave, you know, this room, basically. They go out for recess occasionally, but they're all just in this room together, and that's a better situation for them than getting picked up by their families, who are going to return them to a life of abuse and drugs and all sorts of other things. But it is really extraordinary. It's quite short too. You won't have to spend too much time watching it. It's like 75 minutes long, and it should be coming out in theaters, I think, later this year. But it is a special film, and it's something to keep in mind.
That sounds fascinating. What's the title again?
Starless Dreams.
Well, we will certainly be looking for that when it comes out. In the meantime, you can you can watch the films that you can actually watch.
We're a culture of anticipation, Tasha. This is like Star Wars, kind of.
It is exactly like Star Wars.
Except an Iranian documentary.
I'm going to start writing my fanfic for Starless Dreams right now. And that's it for this week's edition of The Next Picture Show. Our next episodes come out.
Hey guys, producer Genevieve butting in from another space and time to let you know that due to some boring behind-the-scenes administrative stuff, there will be an extra week between this and our next episodes, which will now drop May 17th and 19th. We don't have our pairing for that show selected yet, but if you keep an eye on our Twitter and Facebook pages, we'll announce it there as soon as we know.
In the meantime, we'd love to hear your feedback on this week's discussion of Assault on Precinct 13, Green Room, and anything else film-related. We want to include your thoughts on future episodes of the show. You can leave a short voicemail at 773-234-9730 or email us at comments@nextpictureshow.net. Finally, before closing out this week's episode, where can we find everyone these days? Keith.
You can find me at uprocks.com. I'm writing there and working behind the scenes. And you can also find me at Twitter at kphipps3000.
You can find me on Twitter at @Scott_Tobias. I'm currently writing for NPR, Variety, New York Times, Washington Post, Rolling Stone, Vulture, Village Voice, and as of the beginning of May, I will be the editor-in-chief of Oscilloscope's Musings. Look for some exciting film essays there every week.
You can find me at TheVerge.com, where I'm the resident film critic. We're taping this one a little early because I'm about to head off to the Tribeca Film Festival for 2 weeks. So you can drop in and see a lot of me talking about Tribeca films there. You can also find my interview with Adam Wingard, Simon Barrett, and Dan Stevens at The Dissolve. Scott, where did you interview Jeremy Sonnier for?
Washington Post.
And I interviewed him for The Verge, so there's a lot of us talking to a guy we admire out there. And finally, you can find me on Twitter at Tasha Robinson. You can find producer Genevieve Kosky on Twitter at Genevieve Kosky. You can stay updated on The Next Picture Show via Twitter at Next Picture Pod, via Facebook at facebook.com/nextpictureshow, or by visiting nextpictureshow.net. And if you haven't already, please subscribe to the show on iTunes, Stitcher, or whatever podcast you use, and think about rating and reviewing us on your favorite service. Positive ratings and reviews help move podcasts up the charts to more visible spaces, and every thumbs up literally helps us find new listeners and keep the show going. If you're enjoying what we do, we'd appreciate it if you could give us a shout out on your social media outlet of choice. Thanks again to Genevieve for producing the show, with assistance from Colin the Animal Griffith. And thanks to Delmark Records for providing recording space at their home base, Riverside Studios. And finally, we'd like to thank our parent podcast, Film Spotting, for all their help, input, and support. Please tune in next time.